This week, gold closed at a three-week high due to continued sluggishness in the equities and dollar markets. Well, welcome back to GoldSeek.com Radio, everyone. Your host, Chris Waltzek, here with you for another big show this weekend. James Turk from GoldMoney.com, co-author of the bestseller The Money Bubble, returns to the broadcast with an update on gold backwardation. He says gold has been backdated in 90 out of the past 100 days, and this is, well, unprecedented. The last two times something similar occurred, we saw the last two most powerful rallies in the yellow metal market. Plus, the 2008 credit crisis was just the beginning. Banks are still insolvent, and debt continues to pile up. The end result may eclipse even the last financial bubble in size and scale, making real money, gold and silver, well, necessary components for every investment portfolio. Next up at bat, best-selling author and head of Leib's Market Forecast, Dr. Stephen Leib says that once the EU follows in the Fed's footsteps, applying its own version of QE stimulus, the commodities market and the precious metal sector could benefit while investors seek safe havens to protect their purchasing power. Silver may be down, but it's not yet quite out. The world's shiniest metal will have its day in the sun for a variety of reasons, and when it does, it will outperform AU. Investors should diligently observe the escalating tensions, though, in the Middle East. If the balance of power does tip abruptly, the events could cause a sea change in the U.S. dollar's reserve currency status, in turn boosting the prices of crude oil and commodities. And we certainly saw that this week. Our crude oil picks at the Alpha Stocks newsletter, some of the only green that I saw across the screen this week. Almost every Alpha Stock, actually, I think all alpha picks did remarkably well, including the triple bearish fund. So please log into your Alpha Stocks newsletter account, or you can sign up if you'd like to, or just send an email request to me at gsradio@frontier.com. GoldSeek.com Radio begins now with a Market Weatherman report. Mostly sunny weather appeared over the precious metals exchanges this week. Sharp selling in the equities markets caused investors to lock in some gains, directing the funds instead to the precious metals market safe haven. At Friday's closing bell on the New York COMEX exchange, gold added just shy of $16, finishing at $13.18 an ounce. The yellow metal is still higher for the year by 7%. Silver closed near the break-even point, ending at $19.96. Palladium gained 14, closing at 805 on supply concerns due to sanctions by the West on Russia, still the top global producer. Platinum gained $8, ending at $14.57 an ounce amid the current strike in South Africa. West Texas Intermediate crude gained more than $2, finishing at $103 per barrel. In domestic economic news, gold leaped to the highest level in almost 3 weeks on news Thursday of dovish comments from the Fed's latest FOMC meeting minutes. The news rocked the U.S. dollar, which plunged to a new four-week low on Friday. The new Fed chair, Janet Yellen, noted recently that officials could allow the benchmark Fed funds overnight lending rate to climb about 6 months after the QE operations wrap up, and that's the monthly purchase of toxic debt. However, the newly released March FOMC meeting minutes discounted the likelihood that rates would rise sooner than expected. The minutes showed that several Fed governors expect the Fed funds to rise at a later date. Good news for the precious metals markets. Meanwhile, China became the world's largest gold consumer last year, purchasing a record 2 million pounds of the yellow metal, a 32% increase in bars, coins, and jewelry demand. Demand for bars, coins, and jewelry moved sharply higher to over 1,000 tons in 2013, breaking the barrier, the 1,000-ton barrier. Global jewelry demand also moved 17% higher last year amid lower prices. Elsewhere, bar and coin investment surged 28% in 2013, the highest ever recorded, according to estimates by the World Gold Council. The theme of bullion flowing from Western countries to Asia and the Middle East continues amid concerns over lost purchasing power. The region is home to several gold-hungry nations, including Thailand, South Korea, and Vietnam, not to mention Singapore. All the countries posted record gold import figures. China and India are responsible, though, for more than half of global gold demand. According to a Reuters report, the Reserve Bank of India is now considering to allow 5 private sector banks to import precious metals, effectively lifting import duties that were placed to repair the rupee and the balance of payments. Bottom line on precious metals. The dollar and equities market sell-offs clearly were the key components and factors, I think, sending gold higher this week, which explains why silver failed to follow in gold's tracks. Investors were likely unnerved by the threat of civil unrest as well in Nevada. I think that showdown between the ranchers, militia, and potentially the government does not inspire international confidence. Although this may be played down in the mainline media, it's not really making, I think, the economic headlines. Investors, I think they can read between the lines, are a pretty sharp group, and they recognize that the rose-colored glasses need to come off. This sets a bad precedent, and it really makes the markets nervous, as we saw money just flowing into the precious metals. They're bad news, good news for gold investors. Moving on to the Wall Street Report, cloudy skies hovered over the New York Stock Exchange this week. Equities investors were disappointed by the report, having factored in better figures. Plus, comments from the Fed suggested that QE stimulus could soon end, taking the punch bowl off the stock market exchange floor. For the week, the Dow dropped about 385 points, just shy of 400, ending at 1626, just above that key 16,000 level. The S&P 500 fell 50 points, off nearly 3%, ending at 1815, while the Nasdaq dropped 128 points, by far the biggest percentage loss, falling below that key 4,000 level, but just fractionally below it, under that key support, ending at 3999.74, off 3% for the week. In the past month, though, the index has been hit the hardest. It's highly leveraged. The index is off nearly 10%. Meanwhile, in the U.S., economic news on Thursday of new applications for unemployment benefits declined to the lowest level in 7 years, according to a Labor Department report. Initial jobless claims sank by 32,000 to a seasonally adjusted 300,000 in April. That was the best showing since 2007. The report cited a decrease in company layoffs and improving weather conditions as two primary components behind the economic numbers. Clearly, the frigid winter temperatures this year put a damper on new job creation, and now spring has sprung and warmer temperatures are upon us. Bottom line on Wall Street. Well, last week I suggested the bottom was not yet in place due to sentiment and price, and wow, was that a fortuitous call. Finally, though, the seven-component sentiment index pendulum has swung firmly into that extreme fear level, and this indicates that panic is entering the market. A tradable rally should unfold as soon as next week. However, unless you are a Alpha Stock subscriber, until signs of accumulation appear in the daily and weekly markets, I think caution is advisable. Coming up after the break, more GoldSeek.com radio with Dr. Stephen Leeb and James Turk. It's a pleasure to welcome James Turk back to the show, the founder of GoldMoney.com and co-author of The Money Bubble, a new bestseller. Welcome back, James Turk.
Thanks, Chris. It's always great to speak with you.
Let's begin today, if we could, with a story I think that bodes well for the precious metals sector. You know, the Reserve Bank of India has agreed to allow five of its major banks to import gold without penalties. I'm sure listeners know by now there were some curbs that significantly stemmed the inflow, if you will, of gold across their borders, put some downward pressure on global demand. Premiums that were soaring are now collapsing by as much as 70%. We've seen them drop back down to more normal levels. Do you agree that this new surge in demand could help put a solid floor under the gold price?
Yeah, of course. I mean, India has always consistently been one of the largest buyers of gold. And, you know, they do that in order to protect themselves against the depreciation of the Indian rupee, which has been one of the world's weakest currencies for decades. So the price of gold in terms of the Indian rupee continues to rise. In other words, Chris, you know, gold is an important form of savings in India. It will continue to be that way for, you know, the foreseeable future. So it is a big factor on the gold market, and just another reason to be bullish about gold.
No, I think so. I mean, it certainly can't hurt that the former number one importing nation for the yellow metal is, now firing on all eight cylinders. Well, it'll be interesting to see if India remains in the number two position or if they reclaim their former first place position on gold. You've also commented recently on backwardation, and this is an interesting story. It essentially shows disequilibrium between expectations for gold price, actually for gold in the future. And I wonder if you could tell folks more about why you think this is so significant and how it might send the metals higher.
Yeah, you know, it really comes down to interest rates. And that's what is involved in terms of all currency exchange rates. The higher the interest rate, the weaker the currency. You know, the market basically requires a high interest rate if a currency is more prone to inflation than another currency. So, for example, the Indian rupee has a much higher interest rate than, say, the euro, for the reason that the Indian rupee is likely to be inflated away more so than the euro. And of all of the various monies out there, gold has the lowest interest rate. And what that basically means is that gold has less risk than from inflation or debasement or from central bank actions than any national currency. So normally, you know, that means that gold's spot price is lower than its future price. It's basically a mathematical equation in terms of the way currencies interact and exchange with one another. But occasionally, and very, very rarely, actually, you know, gold might go into what's called backwardation, where the spot price is higher than the future price. And it really shouldn't happen in theory. It happened in 1999 for a couple of days when gold was at an abnormally low level. It happened in 2008 at the, you know, financial crisis when everything was sold, including gold, and that drove gold down to an abnormally low level. For 3 days, it was in backwardation. But over the past several months, gold's been in backwardation 60% of the time. We're talking about, you know, like 90 days of backwardation over the past 180 days or so, which is just, you know, unbelievable that it's happened. And what that essentially means is that just like gold was at an abnormally low level in 1999 and 2008, it is again at an abnormally low level. But compared to the prior two periods, central banks have been intervening in the gold market to keep the gold price as low as it is. So it represents, in my view, a great opportunity to follow the strategy that I've been talking about for years, where, you know, you just continue to dollar cost average by accumulating, you know, gold or accumulating silver, because it's a way of saving money. It's just, the logic is the same as why the Indians buy gold as a form of savings. You know, the whole world should view gold as a form of money and accumulating it over long periods of time as a way of saving money.
No, I think it's well said. I mean, it ultimately is money, whereas fiat currencies are, well, essentially worthless. And I think you do an excellent job there. They're fiat. They're based on faith. This is really the first time in history where that is the case. And so I guess that's a good segue into The Money Bubble, your bestseller, What to Do Before the Bubble Pops. And you tell, I think, an interesting tale about a testimony before Congress with J.P. Morgan in 1912, interestingly and strategically, 1 year before our Federal Reserve was established. You say that this top financier of ours declared that money is gold and nothing else. What an interesting thing to hear from arguably one of the founders of the Federal Reserve. Any comments?
Yeah, you know, back in 1912, when Morgan, J.P. Morgan, gave that testimony before Congress, you know, everybody understood that money was gold. Today, you know, people don't understand that concept. And, you know, getting back to your point about national currencies, which are fiat currencies based on nothing but promises and they're not redeemable into metal, the whole key of the money bubble is that today what people think of as money is not really money in its historical and traditional and true sense. It's a money substitute circulating in place of money. So national currencies are just temporarily filling the gap while we go allow this money bubble to expand. The real money is what J.P. Morgan declared back in 1912 in testimony. Money is gold and nothing else. But we're allowing all of these money substitutes to circulate in place of money. And what this has created is a lot of abnormal conditions in the market. And that's the bubble itself is, you know, we know what a bubble is. We saw it with the dot-com bubble. You know, everybody during the dot-com bubble said that profits don't matter, only market share does. And, you know, after that bubble popped, you know, we realized how that particular conventional wisdom at the time, or during the real estate bubble, everybody said that housing prices only go up. And we all know now that so the conventional wisdom during the housing bubble was wrong. And the same thing with the money bubble. Everybody says that national currencies are money, but they're not. They're only a money substitute circulating in place of money. And when this bubble pops, we'll realize how silly it was to think that a national currency, in fact, is a form of money, because it doesn't actually extinguish a trade. It just is someone else's debt, and this, whether it's a bank or a central bank. And that ultimately distinguishes fiat currency from true money, which is a tangible asset, gold or silver.
You might recall that the former Federal Reserve Chairman, Ben Bernanke, noted that he didn't buy the premise that housing prices could decline, that they had never declined in history. I wonder if he'd ever read any of Professor Shiller at Yale's work, which shows the housing market existed before 1950. There had never really been anything like the bubble we were experiencing over the last 75 years before the housing bubble imploded. There was not a single, even 1% decline in an annual nationwide home price index. So it really was quite the bubble. But there's another bubble on the horizon that folks are looking at or calling for, and that involves debt. And we're hearing of this bond bubble. I wonder how that might factor into your analysis on a forward basis with regard to the precious metals if this new bubble, debt bubble, implodes.
Yeah, that's the key element of the money bubble. And there is a lot of debt today. In fact, there's more debt in the world than there was back in 2007 at the peak of the last bubble before the 2008 collapse. And the sad or tragic thing is, Chris, that none of the problems that appeared in 2008 have been solved. You know, banks are still terribly illiquid. We still have too much debt that cannot be serviced, even at these artificially low interest rates. You know, the debt cannot be serviced. And then they continue to pile on more debt and more debt instead of recognizing that the system itself is at fault and that things need to change. We have to go back to what we had prior to 1971 when national currencies were still at least nominally tied in some way to gold, because unless you have that anchor, you don't have the discipline on governments and their ability to spend. And they just keep printing and printing and printing until ultimately the currency is destroyed. And that's the whole key behind the book, The Money Bubble. And then, of course, the subtitle, What to Do Before It Pops. We basically go through various strategies explaining how people can protect their portfolios from a collapse of the money bubble.
You also say that gold is at the center of all commerce because it is the most liquid, tangible asset in the global economy. I mean, this just makes sense. I mean, look at the central banks. What are the top money financiers worldwide and our governments? How do they transact financially? And for the most part, they keep huge stockpiles of gold on reserves. I mean, we hear that the United States has something like 10,000 tons. So it would seem as though if you really want to understand what money is, you should look at the folks who make it their business.
Yeah, you know, another way of looking at it is, you know, gold has been money for 5,000 years at the center of commerce. It's only since 1971 when the governments have tried to relegate gold to the sidelines. But gold really hasn't been relegated to the sidelines, and the only reason why the gold price has risen since 1971 or even before is because central banks continue to destroy the purchasing power of currencies. So, again, if you have that historical perspective, it makes it much easier to understand that we are indeed in a money bubble. And we don't know when the bubble's going to pop, just like we didn't know when the dot-com bubble was going to pop or the real estate bubble was going to pop. But you know intuitively, and also you know from just studying and looking at history and thinking about it logically, that you do know the bubble is going to pop at some point in time.
And I wonder if we could also address the fact that we're not receiving much fiscal stimulus. You know, the Federal Reserve was essentially shouldering much of the burden trying to revive the economy. And I'd like to know if you think that this could have an impact on their tapering expectations over the last three meetings, I think it is, unless I'm behind one here. They have dropped by about $10 billion at each FOMC meeting the stimulus from the monthly program there. And I'd like to know how you think this could impact the markets going forward. Or is this news, is this story already baked into the market?
Yeah, I think it is already baked into the market. And you know, what they're doing is really very small amount relative to how much they're actually printing. So, you know, I think it was done for, you know, basically propaganda purposes to make the market believe that they're going to go all the way back to where they were in 2007 and reducing the central bank's balance sheet. That's not going to happen. You know, for 100 years since the creation of the Federal Reserve in 1913, pretty much year in and year out, there have been monetary issues of one sort or another. The major one is that the dollar continually loses purchasing power. And that's particularly true over the last, you know, over my lifetime, over 6.5 decades. And that's going to continue for the foreseeable future. And, you know, people have to adjust to that. They have to recognize it and adjust to that by taking those steps to protect themselves so that come what may, they and their families are protected.
I'd like to return to the money bubble. I think what you are calling for is a worldwide implosion of our financial markets. And, you know, I mean, you too were certainly right on the money over a decade ago when you were calling for the gold market to climb. I wonder if you could hit on some of the bullet points from the money bubble and give people a digestible version, synopsis of just how this might come to pass.
Yeah, you know, back in 2004 when we came out with our first book, The Collapse of the Dollar, we had a couple of key themes. As you mentioned, we were saying people should be buying gold. We also said to bet against the housing bubble. But another theme of that was that ultimately the dollar would collapse. And when 2008 came along, we thought, okay, well, you know, that's going to be the collapse of the dollar. And it was for a period of time. You know, after Lehman went under, there was, you know, the outlook looked pretty bleak. But with all of those various money printing and schemes that central banks brought into play, they managed to pump up the bubble one more time and keep it going. And what we've done now in the money bubble is basically re-evaluated all of the basic analysis that we'd put in the collapse of the dollar, added a lot of new analysis to that, and took this big picture point of view as to, okay, how's it going to be playing out over the next several years? And then the key, of course, you know, Chris, is, you know, what things people can do to protect themselves from any type of monetary problems. Because there is going to be a repeat of 2008. There are going to be more crises. You know, in a monetary system which is based on fiat currency, problems with the money are inevitable. And that's what we're seeing now in terms of all of these excesses and balances in the various markets today.
An apt metaphor would be the Federal Reserve chair is just running from one hole in the dam to another, patching the concrete on this side and some makeshift remedy on the other. But eventually, the whole thing has to implode. You know, we really just haven't seen, I think, the issues that brought us to 2008. They never addressed the root causes. You know, they're treating the symptoms, but not the disease. I mean, we haven't returned to anything like the Glass-Steagall Act. I mean, we haven't resolved that problem. The Frank Dodd Act, I think, has done little to help keep history from repeating here.
Governments are going to continue trying to borrow. They're going to continue to try printing money. And history shows that that combination means that it gives politicians the illusion that they can spend ad infinitum. But the reality is that governments, corporations, individuals all have a limited capacity as to how much money they can spend, how much money they can borrow. And governments are going to come to understand that they cannot borrow to infinity because ultimately the currency gets destroyed. And that, sadly, is the way we're headed.
Do you think that ultimately they realize there will be a day of reckoning, or are they so mired in this neo-Keynesian concept that if you print enough money, if you provide enough stimulus, everything will right itself? The ship will come back up. It will not capsize, and the economy will just keep moving forward.
Well, if they were believing that, then they should look at what's happened over the last, you know, 6 years since 2008. They've printed trillions and trillions and trillions of dollars, and we have less people employed in the United States today than we did back in 2007. So, you know, if this formula supposedly works, print money and it solves all problems, why haven't the problems that we saw in 2008 been solved? Why is unemployment still quite high? Why are there few people working in the country today than there were in 2007? I think what the officials are doing First of all, I think there's an absence of leadership and willingness to you know make those changes that are necessary. And what's happened as a consequence, they just don't want the ship of state to go down during their watch. And I think that's what the name of the game has become. Try to keep this bubble floated.
Once Pandora's box is open, there's a sea change. I mean, ultimately, start those incentives and people receive the entitlements, the people begin to realize that they can demand money, and the printing presses, they just never stop after that. Do you want to tell folks more about the money bubble and what's going on at goldmoney.com, please?
The money bubble is available from Amazon, or you can also order it through your local bookstore. And if you're interested in looking at gold and silver as a way of diversifying your portfolio, I'm the founder of Gold Money, or goldmoney.com. And what we do is we enable people to buy gold and silver online and have that stored for them in five different countries around the world.
Very good. Well, we want to thank you for your time today.
Thanks, Chris.
It's a pleasure to have Dr. Stephen Lieb back on the show. The latest of his seven bestsellers includes Red Alert.
That's true.
Well, I understand the weather in New York today is actually improving. It's getting a bit warmer on the East Coast.
Weather in New York is beautiful.
I thought we could begin the dialogue today, if we could, with the precious metals market. It's our listeners' favorite. Now, after recording one of the most impressive rallies in years, the metals have cooled off in the past few weeks. And what I find interesting is that the U.S. dollar, though, well, it's missed every opportunity that it's had to move sharply higher. Why do you think the greenback is having trouble finding momentum here? And what could that mean for the commodities, the CRB index, and the precious metals?
Well, I actually think that one signal for the metals and precious metals in particular to rally will probably be more aggressive steps taken by the European Union to get their economies going. And then I do think you'll see a dollar rally, and I think you'll probably see gold rally on the back of that dollar, believe it or not. I mean, I think the dollar-gold connection is, you know, somewhat overrated. It may work out almost the opposite this time around, in which you have a relatively strong dollar and strong gold at the same time. And the reason being, once the Europeans start, aggressively easing monetary policy, you're going to get a lot of growth. And I think you're going to stimulate a lot of demand for commodities. If you go back, Chris, to the commodity charts, you find that most, or at least a lot of the indices, it really didn't make peaks in 2008, but they made peaks in 2011. And that was almost to the month when the European countries went into a funk. They had six consecutive quarters of negative growth, and commodities came down. And the Eurozone is the world's most important and largest economic bloc. I think that what's happened in the Ukraine is kind of a sidebar to the implications. And you know, one of many, many implications is that the European Central Bank has to be very, very careful that these peripheral countries maintain strong growth, or else, you know, they could drift eastward themselves, especially the Baltic countries, Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia. They have to be very, very careful, and I think that's really been a sort of set a fire under them to start stimulating their own economies, and I think you'll see metals lift with that, precious metals in particular. I mean, they tend to, you know, follow commodities, and eventually As is always the case, you probably have a little bit too much of a good thing. And I think that that will lead to, you know, a major rally in gold.
You've made that interesting correlation with the euro. You said something to the effect that, you know, we're looking at about a half a billion people there as opposed to the United States, roughly 300 million. I mean, it truly is an economic engine to be contended with. So we're thinking of China, looking at them for all the growth, but we can't ignore Europe.
No, you can. And, you know, per capita income, et cetera, Europe is a considerably larger economy than China. And, you know, when it grows into a funk, I mean, it really was, you know, kind of a historic post-war funk, six consecutive quarters of decline. It's going to take its toll. And it certainly has taken its toll. But, I mean, you know, over the past few weeks when you've heard talk of a more aggressive monetary stance among the European countries, especially the Bundesbank going along with quantitative easing, I mean, that's like cows recommending steak for dinner. It's a strong sign that they mean business. They really know that they've got to go after economic growth, or else they could face very, very serious consequences.
And I wonder if you might address one of your recent calls for the yellow metal of $2,000 to $2,500 that we could actually see, at least on a nominal basis, higher levels with gold. I mean, we've really experienced quite a reaction here, and it seems like we've put in a floor, at least for the time being. You expect the typical forces that were in play back in the early 2000s to support the precious metals here, and then a resurgence of economic growth in Europe. Are you concerned at all about some sluggish economic reports coming from China?
No, I'm not really that concerned. I mean, obviously, you know, you've got an economy as large and complex as China. There are going to be a lot of cross currents there, especially as they kind of transition from a export-driven to a consumer-driven economy. But they have massive infrastructure spending ahead of them that's going to make a lot of sense for them to do, especially in terms of building up a energy infrastructure that I think they want to build, and they would hope will last them for the next 100 years. I think they're well ahead of us and well ahead of almost everybody else in terms of doing that, with the possible exception of Germany. I mean, they've also done a lot of work in building renewable energies, et cetera. But China, I mean, they're going to be spending, I mean, north of $1 trillion over the next 4, 5, 6 years, well north of $1 trillion, putting up a smart grid and putting in renewable energies and getting set for this century. And that, I think, will sustain growth in that country for a long time to come.
Well, I wanted to ask you about this trend we've seen in China regarding physical gold. You know, we've had quite a shift from a prohibition on gold ownership to overtly encouraging ownership. You've gone on record recently saying that officials are laying the groundwork potentially for a gold-backed currency. Any comments?
Yeah, I think for sure. I think that, you know, right now, you know, I think the dynamics in the world, the economic dynamics in the world are really shifting, and they're shifting east. You know, probably away from our country and much, much more toward China, Russia, to some extent, and Germany. You know, what was kind of lost in this recent, you know, Ukraine disaster or whatever. I mean, you know, don't want to say anything good about Putin because there's nothing really good to say about him. But, you know, nevertheless, he's, you know, taken advantage of certain economic levers that he has. And, you know, one of them is that his railway, Germany's railway, their partners, basically transport a lot of goods between Germany and China. And the amount of goods are increasing and increasing rapidly. And, you know, this is a very, very big block. I mean, China, Russia, Germany, et cetera. And you consider their proximity to the Middle East, there are a lot of edges that they have. And I think that they, you know, eventually envision a day in which there will be a basket of currencies, and it will include or have, quite a bit of gold in it, and not too many dollars. And I think that that's basically the way the world is shifting at this point. I think, you know, I don't know how many years down the road, but a few, maybe. I don't think you'll see oil priced in dollars anymore. I think you'll see it priced in terms of a basket of currencies, of which, you know, gold will certainly, and gold, and the yuan. And I think some of these currencies, you know, I don't know whether it'll follow Bretton Woods exactly, but I mean, some of these currencies might be directly convertible into gold. like the yuan, like even maybe the German mark standing alone. I don't know. I mean, I have no idea exactly how it plays out, but it does seem the world is shifting from west to east. You will have a new standard, a new type of world currency, and the dollar will play a very small role, or a much, much, much smaller role in that than it does today.
It's interesting. And, you know, we've seen quite a bit of support under West Texas Intermediate crude in recent years and even recently. It's interesting to note that it has essentially treaded water in a very broad consolidation now for, it seems like, almost 5 years. It looks as though the crude oil market is waiting for some impetus to send it substantially higher. Do you concur, or do you see something else happening there?
I do concur. I think oil prices could go dramatically higher. But I don't know whether it's going to happen in 3 months or 30 months. But I think that the U.S. has made, I think, really a fatal bet on fracking. And it could last another, couple of years. I mean, we could continue to increase oil production, but then it stops. I mean, there's only so much productivity you can get out of every rig. Once that productivity starts leveling off, you just need more and more rigs because the decline rates are so, so high that it just doesn't become feasible. It doesn't become cost effective. In fact, you can always get oil out of the ground, but it may start costing, $150, $200, who knows how much. And that will be a very bad sign. And that could be not only a reason for oil to go a lot higher, but that could be the catalyst that causes us to shift off the dollar as a way of pricing oil. I mean, that I think would be very, very important. I mean, this country has really, I think, almost bet the farm on, energy independence vis-a-vis fracking. And I just don't see that working out. I hope I'm dead wrong on this, incidentally. I hope I'm completely wrong on it. But I fear, because I think that the logic behind it just doesn't suggest a long-term solution for this at all. Doesn't suggest it is a long-term solution to our energy problems or our energy needs. It just doesn't. So I think that's what I would keep an eye on, and I think that probably will be the most important catalyst that you'll see over the next several years, decline in production rates of oil in this country. Now, again, I can't say whether that's going to start happening in 3 or 6 or 30 months, but it will happen in the not-too-distant future.
That is certainly not good news for the United States, but it's, I guess, music to the ears of fans of photovoltaics. What an interesting tie-in, because I know you're a huge fan, as am I. We've discussed in the past many times solar panels and their amazing qualities and the way that they've increased efficiency in recent years. And we've also talked about the fact that just a 100-watt solar panel can require up to an ounce of silver to manufacture. What a hot sector. At one point in recent months, solar-related companies, First Solar and others, were the hottest sector. I think I read somewhere at bigcharts.com that there was nearly a 1,000% increase.
Solar is growing very rapidly, and, some of the manufacturers of photovoltaics are growing, too, are doing very, very well in the market, like Giga Solar, which is a Taiwanese company that I follow. And silver itself, though, has been kind of dead in the water, which I just find, I'd be very, very honest, I find it very puzzling. I don't like to, talk about conspiracy or things being held down, et cetera. But if I were to bet that there was something going on in one particular market right now, it would probably be silver. I have no idea why it's still trading near $20. I mean, I honestly think it should be closer to $35, $40, $50, $60. Much, much higher prices. There have been these rumors in the silver market for years and years that it's being manipulated. I don't place that much credence in it, but it certainly seems odd in the face of, the performance of stocks, again, like Giga Solar. I mean, unfortunately, you can't buy it in this country. You have to, you have to be able to speak, Mandarin or Cantonese and live in Taiwan. If you look at it, it's certainly belies a dead silver market. I mean, it really is a stock dedicated to photovoltaics and silver paste, in particular, and the stock has gone gangbusters. And its earnings have gone gangbusters. And historically, silver had followed this stock pretty faithfully, and it kind of stopped. So in fact, I'm just punching up the stock now, Chris. And, you know, stock has gone from, 300 to 700 in the year to date. Yeah. And, you know, you see things that are like, you know, pretty obvious. Quoting the description of the company, Giga Solar Materials manufactures solar conductive paste to provide solar energy. So it's difficult to connect the dots when you see a company, which is fairly substantial, doubling in not too long a period of time, yet what they're, you know, relying on as raw product, basically just staying, fit and just staying, just sitting still. I think silver will have its day. That's the bottom line. And I think when it does, it'll be explosive. It really, really will take off. It'll be a, gangbusters. Now, one reason could be copper. Copper's kind of been a laggard and might be a laggard this year because, there's a little bit of excess copper production and that might run into 2016 or so. But I just don't see any excess silver production at all, and I have no reason. I just don't have an explanation.
The problem might lead to the solution. The very fact that people are relegating silver to the industrial metal category could bode well for its future prospect.
Yeah, no, it absolutely could. And like I said, these things tend to straighten themselves out. And I think you will have you'll have a massive rally in silver. I really do.
One of my picks, First Solar, I recommended it right around 35 to 37. It's a horse race. You're a nose ahead of me here. 37, and it's about 73 now, so probably not quite 100% that you have. But you know what? I think this company, FSLR, is on the verge of a breakout. Please, folks, don't take that as a recommendation. It's just a fantastic company. Great fundamentals. Financials are really sound. And the technicals are great. I want to see this company north of 100, something to put on people's radar screen. Also wanted to ask you about the rare earth elements. This is another area that you've been watching closely, one of the few people to do so. I want to give the listeners an idea of just how essential these are. I mean, it's in virtually just like silver, but we see it in everything from hard drives on your desktop and your laptop. If you ever need a rare earth magnet, you have some of those outdated hard drives sitting around, crack one open, you'll have a wonderfully powerful magnet for free. Wind turbines, and hydraulic turbines. So these are very hot, just like solar panels. You need rare earths to produce high quality turbines.
I think that what you say is absolutely true. I guess from the 50s on, every decade you saw a quantum leap in permanent magnets and their power. And then all that stopped with the advent of rare earths around mid-1980s, and we really haven't made any real progress in developing stronger magnets since, mid-late 1980s. And even the research that you see today on some of the nanotechnologies still focus on rare earths, because it's rare earths that have been at the center of high-level magnetism and permanent magnets. And there's a lot you cannot do without permanent magnets, and you name some of them. A lot of electronic equipment relies on them. A lot of very advanced defense equipment relies on rare earths. Right now, we don't have any real of the important rare earths. We basically don't have any supply. I mean, we have one major rare earth company that's operating, that's Molycorp, but they don't produce the kind of rare earths you need for magnets, which are the heavy rare earths. And we don't have the supply chain from getting the ore out of the ground, rare earth ore out of the ground, to actually producing a permanent magnet. I mean, there's probably 6 to 10 steps in that chain. And the only country that, you know, really can do it right now is China. I mean, not only are they the biggest supplier of rare earth ore, they are also the only country that has an absolute soup-to-nuts supply chain for producing rare earths. It's another, you know, area where we've really got to get on our horse and start moving fast. There are other rare earth deposits out there, heavy rare earth deposits. But the point is that there hasn't been any real effort to put up, you know, the other parts of the supply chain you're going to need in order to get from those rare earths to those heavy rare earths to permanent magnets. I mean, that's a very, very technical, refined process. And it takes a lot of education, a lot of technique. And we don't produce the engineers in this country right now, at least we're not producing them, that have that capability. And, you know, that's why, you know, Molycorp has to ship their ore off to China in order to have it processed. And if these other companies like Ucor, et cetera, which we've talked about and recommended them, that they've done very, very well, but they're also going to need access to all these other processing, refining, separation. I mean, all the things that go into, you know, getting heavy rare earths, they don't have it. They may rely on China, too, which is it's just not a good position to be in. I mean, we should be in a position where we really control our own fate, especially in an area as vital as this. And, you know, the irony here, Chris, is that, you know, the new technologies that you see surrounding rare earths and the efforts to come up with other forms of permanent magnets rely on rare earths. And, you know, you use nanotechnologies, okay, that's fine. But, you know, what percent of the weight of the magnet are there? What percent of the nanoparticles are rare earth? And a lot. I mean, there just doesn't appear to be any way around our need for these heavy rare earths. And, you know, I'm not saying that it's a hopeless situation, but it's something that just doesn't seem to be on our radar screen right now. And we should put it there very, very high up.
Agreed. And I hope that some sharp listener comes up with a way, devises a method for recycling rare earths, because they're becoming, you know, much more prevalent in our items today.
They really are. And I think anything we can do to improve or facilitate their availability would just be great. It would just be doing this country a tremendous service.
A possible way to benefit your country as well as profit for your family as well. So
absolutely, absolutely, yes.
Everybody wins. Well, as we wrap up today, is there anything else on your radar screen that you'd like to share with the listeners?
I would keep a very careful eye on what's going on with the Iranian nuclear talks. I think they're, you know, more than important right now. I think that there has been a sense is that Saudi Arabia is very upset with the United States, and I think that that's a major concern. It really is. And I think that we have to be extremely careful how we handle these talks. I think we have to be extremely careful what role Russia is going to start playing in the world. And we have to continue to remind ourselves that Russia and China are neighbors. They have like $500 billion energy pact right now. That's a lot of money. They have a lot of mutual interests in common. Those mutual interests really don't include us other than as a peripheral player. So, yeah, there's a lot to watch. There really is right now an awful lot to watch. I do think that we have to watch what's going on in the East and the Middle East. It's going to be very, very easy to lose control of these situations. I really do. I mean, I can envision, I'm not saying I'm predicting this, but I certainly can envision a situation in which Iran has control of the, not control, but has basic control over the Iranian nuclear facilities. By virtue of that, has a lot of sway over in Saudi Arabia, and Russia does. I mean, Russia has control over Iranian nuclear facilities, which gives them a lot of sway in Saudi Arabia, China a lot of sway in Saudi Arabia. These are the kind of dynamics that make for a change in reserve currency status. I mean, all the Saudis have to do, I mean, despite everything that we've seen, is say that they want to price their oil in something other than dollars, and then the world shifts. It's like a, you know, like an earthquake, and a monetary earthquake, and that could happen. And it's, you know, I really would keep your eye on the headlines on the front pages as well as what you see on the internet on the financial pages. It's a German alliance too. I mean, you know, what struck me. And I did write a little bit about it, was when, you know, the Ukraine thing first broke out, the president of China, Xi, had paid a visit to Germany, and he was in Duisburg, I'm not sure how to pronounce it, but, you know, that's a city that houses the largest land-based port in the world. And the reason he was visiting there, trains from that port make a 6,800-mile journey three times a week, delivering goods back and forth between Germany and China. And they hope to, you know, that was once a week a couple of years ago. Now it's three times a week, and they hope to raise it to seven times a week, once a day. And a lot of growth is dependent on these trains, and these trains are controlled by Russian railways in conjunction with German railways. So, I mean, Russia is already a critical cog in the whole German economy. We don't know this. I mean, we're not conscious of this. I mean, you know, it was almost laughable to hear Merkel rebuke Putin. I mean, there's absolutely nothing she can do about it. Nothing, nothing. I mean, these alliances are coming together right in front of our noses, and we're just sort of like shrugging our shoulders.
Dr. Lieb, we appreciate that massive database you call a brain. I'm going to look forward to having you back on the show. I hope that you're feeling better, and very kind of you to take time from your busy schedule for us today.
No, appreciate it, Chris. I always do. I always like talking to you. Okay, bye-bye.
Hey Chris, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com. The canary in the coal mine is beginning to sing louder and louder. But just like before when this precious little bird sings, is anyone really listening? And moreover, is anyone making preparations to act? Family Dollar stores, which caters to lower-income shoppers, many who live paycheck to paycheck, recently reported that sales at stores open for more than a year had fallen 3.8% in the quarter that ended March 1st. It also anticipates sales to decline this quarter as well. As a result, the company is cutting prices, jobs, and closing hundreds of stores. Family Dollar's chief executive officer, Howard Levine, on a conference call with investors, pointed to a more financially constrained consumer, which is code for what Walmart said a few weeks ago when it announced a sharp cut in food stamp benefits and higher payroll taxes had, quote, pinched its customers. So is the economy really getting any better when those that cater to the lowest on the economic ladder continue to struggle with declining sales and less traffic in their stores? Clearly, there is still a very large part of the economy where price matters, and it matters a lot. People are selling stuff on Craigslist just to make ends meet. Local shop owners are downsizing again to try and maintain some semblance of reasonable overhead as local taxes, cost of goods, and especially the cost of maintaining employees continues to escalate. If lower income individuals are being squeezed now, wait until natural gas prices skyrocket in both the U.S. and Europe as a result of the Russian, Crimean, Ukrainian tensions and the global posturing that is resulting. Other military conflicts have centered around oil. The next will include a natural gas component. As energy prices continue to rise, the consumer will continue to get squeezed. Round and round she goes, and where she stops, we always know. planned conflict, higher energy prices, inflation, and an elongated treadmill on a slope to a declining standard of living for more and more people the world over. That's just the way life is. But you can do something about it. At least for yourself, your family, and maybe a few close friends. Beyond that, the world is on its own. And until next time, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com, reminding you to follow us on Twitter @ConquerChange. Thanks, Chris.